name is Neil Middleton, and every month we create informative content for you as we talk to important, influential, and inspirational people from the world of bats, as well as other areas of interest. To find out more about Batability, go to batability.co.uk. Now for the interview. Let's do it. Welcome everybody. And okay, you may have noticed that this time it's not a talking bat interview, it's a talking mustelid interview, because I am delighted to say that on Talking Mustelid, on this occasion, we have Johnny Birks. Now, I met Johnny for the first time, goodness, late on in 2022, when he very kindly did a webinar on pine martens for Batability. And ever since that webinar, I've been thinking to myself, I've got to talk to this guy some more. I've got to find out a little bit more about what he's all about, where he came from, how he got here. You know how it goes, folks. So here we are, Dr. Johnny Birks. Johnny, how are you doing today?
I'm great, thanks, Neil. And it's lovely to see you again.
Likewise. Now, I sometimes do this, and I'm going to do this on this occasion. When you woke up this morning and you remembered that you were doing this, what's your immediate thought? Oh my word, why did I ever agree to this? Or was it, I'm really looking forward to it? And please be truthful.
It was definitely the latter. I love talking about mustelids. I love digging into my increasingly dodgy memory. And I suppose my only worry was, crikey, I might forget some of the important things that I've been involved in. But no, I'm sure you will coax them out of me somehow.
Yeah, I'll try my absolute best. So here we go, folks. Just a quick introduction to Johnny Birks. Goodness. Okay. So, beguiled by pine martens since his teens, I'm going to ask him about this in a moment, a researcher on mustelids, you know, generally, but specifically done an awful lot of work on pine martens. He's previously been in the Nature Conservancy Council and worked for English Nature. He then went on to Vincent Wildlife Trust. He's co-founder of Swift Ecology Limited, which he founded with other directors in 2007, retired from that position in 2019. And no, folks, I didn't miss one out. I'm just trying to do things chronologically. Whilst at Swift Ecology, he had a period of time when he was the chairman of the Mammal Society, also an author, a conservationist, and an activist, and dare I say it, a pretty good-looking baby as well, yeah? So I'm allowed to ask Johnny, how long ago was the baby picture taken, or... You know,
yeah, the baby picture, that was December 1956, when I was maybe 7 months old. And in those days, not only did they have mainly black and white cameras, but they put little babies in funny little smocks.
Yeah, yeah.
Baby fashion has changed a lot since then. So what I like about that picture is I don't have a long beaky nose in that picture. That must have grown much later. But I look quite thoughtful. I think I was thinking about mustelids already, even at that stage, although that's just a guess.
And if you could go back to your very early childhood, okay, maybe a good few years after this baby shot, maybe 8, 9, 10 years old, were you interested in wildlife, natural history at that point? Or when did that occur? And why did it occur?
It came pretty early. So yes, by 9, 10, I was pretty obsessed with wildlife. I had a little kind of old-fashioned box camera thingy that I used to take awful pictures of birds that were just a dot on a roof, you know. But to me, they were special because I could remember what I was doing at the time and enjoying the sound and the sight. I can remember one of my school projects when I was about probably 10 years old was I found a fox's breeding earth after it had been vacated. And I recovered all the prey remains and I stuck them on a huge piece of cardboard. And that was my school project, these stinking bits of bone and fur and feather. And to me, it was just magic. So yeah, I got stuck into wildlife very early on. And something that helped, it probably in my early teens, I had a very eccentric aunt who I loved madly. She was my Auntie Molly, and she gave me my first ferret. And that's what got me really hooked on the mustelids. He was called Pico, and he was gorgeous. He was the love of my life when I was an early teenager.
Wow. So your parents, they must have been quite encouraging as well, or was it all down to your Aunt Molly?
No, my parents were very encouraging. I think they were a bit cross with my Auntie Molly by bringing this smelly ferret into our lives, perhaps before they were intending things like that. But no, they were very, very encouraging. My dad used to take me fishing early in the mornings before he went to his job. He was a teacher. And sitting still by the riverbank, again, was just a brilliant way to see wildlife. So yeah, I had a great upbringing, pretty rural, conventional, but a lot of time outdoors. And that was brilliant.
So obviously, well, I suspect obviously, it's the ferret that brought you to pine martens. But look, engaging with pine martens in, you know, their wild form in the natural world, that's not an easy species to see, to come across, to find out that much about, especially in the 1960s. How did you get this link to pine martens? Because it's almost like you've been beguiled at that point by something that I'm imagining you probably never seen that much in the wild, or had you been very fortunate and you'd come across them somewhere?
No, it all came through magazines and books. I was a big fan of fictional books like Henry Williamson's Animal Saga, which didn't mention pine martens, but it got me into mammals in a big way. Things like Tarka the Otter, Brock the Badger. What was the name of the guy who wrote about pine martens? H.G. somebody or other. Okay. His name will come to me. But anyway, I learned about pine martens from him. And as you say, they were so rare in the 1960s and 70s, so restricted to the Highlands of Scotland, although we know they were still in one or two other places in England and Wales, we believe. So they were like really, really remote. You know, it was my holy grail, the pine marten, and it wasn't till much, much later that I was able to get close to them and see them up in Scotland.
Wow.
But okay, they were even then, I was enchanted, absolutely gripped. Before pine martens also actually came polecats through the ferrets. Pico was the first of many. So I got to know polecats a little bit more intimately than I did pine martens, even though I was fascinated by both.
Okay, amazing stuff. There's a couple of things also on this list here that I want to touch on briefly, and there are a few things that we're going to go into a lot more detail about. So we're going to go into a lot more detail about swift ecology, your experience as an author, and what you're doing these days since you've retired. But just going back in time a little bit before that, how did you end up getting your first paid position in the ecological sector, which I'm assuming was the Nature Conservancy Council position? But was that easy? What was the kind of lead up to that? Yeah. And you then going on to English Nature and VWT?
The Nature Conservancy Council, the NCC, that was my first proper permanent job. But before then, as was so common, I had several temporary contracts. So one of my I suppose one of the landmark ones was I did part of the second National Otter Survey of England, which was funded by the NCC, but it was done through the University of Exeter. And all I was given a camper van to live in and a list of about 3,000 river sites that I had to go and check for signs of otters. And that was in 1984. I got that post. And yeah, it was a real eye opener because at that stage, otters were near the bottom of their sort of status in England. And 90% of the sites I went to had no signs of otters whatsoever. So 10% were positive, and they had crept up from 6% in the late 1970s. So by then, by the mid-80s, we had phased out the organochlorine pesticides that were the main cause of their decline. So they were just beginning to bottom out and begin to recover. And it gave me a lot of time living on my own, thinking about nature and the problems it was facing. So I had a lot of time for reading, and that was possibly an important time for me to step from being just keen on wildlife to really, really caring about the causes of wildlife decline. And then after that, partway through that, actually, the Wildlife and Countryside Act had been passed in 1982, and that led to new protections for sites of special scientific interest. And the NCC at the time was able to persuade government that they needed a lot more staff to make this, it was called renotification of the SSSI system. And I was able to get a job with the Nature Conservancy Council here in the West Midlands, in Malvern, actually. And that was my first proper job as an assistant regional officer with the Nature Conservancy Council. And my main job was to go and talk to landowners of sites of special scientific interest and break the bad news to them that there was this new legislation that was going to place new obligations upon them to help them protect nature better. That was a challenging time.
So what sort of age were you at that point when you got that first position?
I suppose I would have been late 20s by then. You see, I'd done a PhD on wild mink down at Exeter University in the late 70s, finished in early 80s. Then I went up to Durham University and did some postdoctoral research on mink living on the coast of Scotland, the Galloway coastline. And that was fascinating and a lot of fun as well, getting to know that corner of Scotland, which I've been going back to every year for many years now. Over 20 years, I've been going to Galloway, mainly for pine martins now. And then after postdoc research, I was unemployed for a while. I went on an expedition to Greenland to study Arctic foxes. And then soon after that, I got the otter survey job. And then I got the permanent job with the Nature Conservancy Council. So yeah, I would have been in my late 20s, I guess.
If you're enjoying listening to our podcasts, perhaps you would also be interested in joining Batability Club. To find out more about Club, which includes hundreds of hours of accessible training resources available to you in your own time and at your pace, go to batability.co.uk. Thank you. And then you move on to English Nature. Do you want to talk briefly about that? Yeah.
Yes. I'll try not to get too political about this, Neil, but the Nature Conservancy Council, in the good work that it did, and it was called a quango in those days, which means a quasi non-governmental organization. And quangos were more independent of government than things are these days. So we were actually allowed to tell the truth. And if we saw a problem, even though we were government funded, if we saw a problem, we were allowed to explain what it was and how it could be fixed. that's become much rarer nowadays for government-funded organizations. And the NCC upset a few of the government's friends. And I won't give too much detail, but there were powerful people who wanted us to be emasculated. So before the end of one of the regimes, it was suddenly announced that the Nature Conservancy Council would be split into three separate country agencies, one for Scotland, one for Wales, and one for England. There was no forethought and planning given to it at all, but it satisfied some promise that a government minister had made. Ever since then, nature conservation funded by government has been more under the thumb of government and less independent. So yes, I worked for English Nature, which was the English successor body, for a year or two, but I found it uncomfortable because we were constrained from telling the truth all the time. So I started plotting my escape.
Okay, and that's what takes you, I imagine, to Vincent Wildlife Trust. Bear, I think I read somewhere in the last couple of days, you actually landed a job there dealing with your favourite subject, did that kind of work out like that initially, or did you?
It was polecats. Polecats were...
Polecats.
They were my official job. Okay. I was privileged to know the Honourable Vincent Weir, who was the kind of brainchild and funder of the Vincent Wildlife Trust.
Okay.
I didn't know him at all well at that stage, but I was able to write to him and explain that something interesting was happening in the English Midlands, which was that animals that looked like polecats were turning up in the English Midlands a long way from where all the books said they were mainly found, which was Wales and the Welsh borders. And so I wrote to Vincent Weir and said, there's a really exciting project here to investigate what seems to be the recovery of one of our rare, lesser known mustelids, which was the polecat. We had the complication, of course, that polecats interbreed with feral ferrets and you get these hybrids and not everybody can readily tell the difference, even me, readily tell the difference between a hybrid ferrety polecat or a polecatty ferret and the true wild polecat. So anyway, Vincent, to his credit, he may have been mad, I don't know, but anyway, he invited me up to London to see him and I explained what I thought we could do and he made me an offer, which was very generous, that I could take a secondment from English Nature and work for the Vincent Wildlife Trust on the recovery of the polecat in the English Midlands. And that was a fabulous time. And that was the beginning of my career for several years with the Vincent Wildlife Trust, which was a really, really good period of my life because I was able to concentrate on the stuff that I felt I was quite good at and was fascinated by.
Amazing stuff. Okay, so we're going to just focus on one other thing before I move on. You were chairman of the Mammal Society 2009 to 2015. At the same time, during that period, you were running or involved in running Swift Ecology Limited. You were saying to me before we switched the camera on that that was quite a challenging time for you, because I would imagine trying to do justice to both positions, which would have been extremely demanding, even if you were just doing one of those things, but trying to do justice to both of those things, that must have put you under a bit of pressure, I would imagine. Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it was a hard time. And of course, I had a wife and two young children as well, and they had their needs. And finding that balance was really, really hard. And I really felt the strain. Because the Mammal Society, its membership is relatively small still. considering the good work that it does. And I had been a member since, I think, 1977, 78, I first joined. Wow. And I've met so many fabulous people that I've remained friends with ever since then. You know, some of them are really old people now. But they were like my other family, my other extended family, because we maybe only meet once a year, but it's like we've never kind of stopped talking, because you just carry on where you left off from the previous year at conferences. So the annual conferences, which have been upset since COVID, they were a fabulous period every year to kind of re-inspire me and reconnect me with things that I know are important and interesting research going on. So for anybody who is interested in mammals, I would highly recommend the Mammal Society. It's a great organization, and it does deserve more support. But yeah, I was honored to be asked to be chair, and it's a 6-year term. It's completely unpaid, although I think they paid my train fare if I felt they could afford it. Sometimes they couldn't. So yeah, that was an honor, but a strain, and doing that whilst also trying to fulfill my commitments to Swift Ecology, which was a very ethically sound ecological consultancy run by good people, of which I was just one. It's still going strong, and I'm still in touch with my friends who still work there. And yeah, we were on a steep learning curve when it started in 2007. It felt rocky because, of course, the financial crash happened in 2008, just yeah. After we had set up Swift Ecology. The three of us were all fairly new to it. My friend Lisa Kerslake was the only one really experienced in ecological consultancy. So we relied heavily on her to guide us as to how things should happen.
Yeah. And I suppose, because I've been through a similar journey myself, I founded Echoes Ecology in 2006. But going from somewhere like, you know, NCC, English Nature, Vincent Wildlife Trust, to basically running a commercial organization that's going to have commercial clients, you know, tight deadlines, you know, lots of challenges, just, you know, understanding how the business world works. How did you and your co-directors find that? Was there a lot of learning on the non-ecological side of running a business as well as the ecological side?
Absolutely. Yes, it was a really steep learning curve. And I personally relied heavily on Lisa Kerslake to help me understand how things needed to be done, because in all my previous employments, I'd kind of been sheltered from the commercial side, the filthy money side of everything. So yeah, it was. And then the other side that I found hard was the fact that it was no longer really pure conservation. Very often It was firefighting. It was often limiting the damage, making the best of a bad job. But possibly the hardest part of it I found was what I call the piggy in the middle element, where you're serving really two separate entities. You have the client, and they want their planning permission as cheaply as they can get it. And then the other entity you have to serve, or you have to persuade the client to serve, are the regulatory authorities. So the local planning authority, who have their obligations to biodiversity, and the bodies like Natural England and Environment Agency and people like that. So we consultants are very often stuck between these two competing needs that pull us in each direction. And it's never a very comfortable place to be. And I know a lot of really good people working in consultancy that actually wish they were doing something that was closer to pure conservation.
Yeah,
and I feel sorry for them. And I was relieved when I was able to take slightly early retirement. I was also very fortunate in Swift Ecology that we had a really strong ethical basis to our work. And we just wouldn't work for certain clients because we knew their demands would be unreasonable and unacceptable to us as conservationists. So we were in a position where we did sometimes just say, no, not doing it for you. It meant that we never made very much money. We made enough, just enough to live on. But we never made much compared with what some firms do. It stayed a fairly small firm, but it's proud and it has its integrity. And that's something I'm always grateful for.
Yeah, so as you're suggesting there, as you're saying there, and the way you're talking about it, I can feel in the words you're using that you're quite proud about what you achieved there. I mean, it's something you've created yourselves. It's something that started off, I would imagine, on a blank bit of paper without any clients on day one or leading up to day one. And I suppose it means that as a team, you're having to be quite creative about building the business, designing things like websites, logos, branding, core values, all this kind of stuff, you know, that you sound as if you're looking back on, you know, with an element of pride, to say the least. Yeah.
Yes, very much so. Yes, it was. It was a very steep learning curve. And although there were three of us directors, we also had a full workload of field work and report writing, because we were never big enough to have a set of directors that did nothing but direct. You know, we all had to be actively involved in doing the survey work, which was good because that's what we were good at.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a few more of these things shortly, but Johnny sent me a selection of photographs before today's interview commenced. And okay, starting at the top left, that's a bit of tree hugging, or are you trying to scale a tree to get to get a mustelid or something? What's going on there?
That was a photograph sent to me by an old university friend some years ago. And that's when I was at Exeter University as an undergraduate. I believe I was on a conservation volunteers task. And somebody said, oh, Johnny, I bet you can't climb that tree with no shoes on. And so up the tree I went. I am what I can sometimes call myself a closet exhibitionist. You know, I'm not shy of doing silly things from time to time. So that was me as a student. Possibly there's a connection with pine martins there. You know, maybe I'm letting out my inner pine martin, albeit not climbing very well. So yeah, that was that. The next one to the right.
Yeah.
That was
before you say anything, okay? Right. So I'm looking at that picture, right?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what I'm seeing here, right? I'm seeing somebody that looks as if they've just woken up, yeah? Lying in bed. Mm. And I initially thought that was a jug of beer you were holding, but I think it's just a beer-coloured cup, is that right?
No, it's a cup of tea.
It's a cup of tea. Because from a distance, yeah. when I first saw that photograph, I thought, he's just woken up, but somebody's handed him a pint of beer. And no. You're wearing a T-shirt that's to do with an expedition to Kenya. So anyway, you tell us about the picture. Yeah,
yeah, that T-shirt, I never actually went on that expedition. So I must have been given it or left it by a friend. But it dates it. I know that picture was taken in around about 1985. I'm sorry, my cat is making such a noise. I can't turn the cat off.
No, that's so good. That's so good.
That picture in the mid-1980s, it was a significant time for all sorts of reasons. That mug, I remember buying that mug with another mug at Camden Lock Market in London, where you could buy all sorts of interesting stuff. That's a rather posh Laura Ashley duvet cover. And then my hairstyle and my beard was my attempt to be the wild man of the woods look. But I've spoilt it with the posh tea mug and the duvet cover. But the 1980s are important to me because it's when I got my first proper job. It was an important time for nature conservation to me because it was when things weren't great for wildlife, because obviously we had the big phase of agricultural intensification in Britain that had created a lot of declines in wildlife. But conservation organisations were getting well organised. So the NCC, the Nature Conservancy Council, was quite well funded by government. A lot of the wildlife trusts, the county wildlife trusts, were tapping into good money to employ more staff and acquire new reserves. The RSPB was going from strength to strength. Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace were doing great campaigning work. So, you know, there was a lot of good action going on in nature conservation. And the other thing about the 1980s was this was the decade when the consensus really began to grow that we were facing big problems with climate change. You know, the scientific evidence and the consensus was getting established in that decade.
Yeah, absolutely. I once had hair as long as that as well. Okay, would you believe? But that was a long time ago. Right, moving on to the next pictures, which are all mustelid related, I would imagine. Do you want to just talk around some of the memories about the remaining three pictures? Yeah.
All the other three pictures are from different parts of Galloway Forest. And that's where, with my friend John Martin, I've been going for 20 years in collaboration with what used to be the Forestry Commission. It's now gone through various acronyms. It's now Forestry and Land Scotland. They're the major owner of Galloway Forest. And with them, we've been doing work on pine martens, particularly focused around putting up den boxes to see if we can improve the habitat, improve the breeding success and the populations of martens in conifer plantations. And it's been the most magical, uplifting, positive experience to be studying a species, a beautiful, enchanting mammal like the pine marten, which has been recovering at long last, has been really good for my spirits and still is. And even though I'm supposed to be retired, I still do things like that with FLS in Scotland and with Forestry England in Northern England, looking at ways in which we can help pine martens recover, particularly in the big commercial conifer plantations that were established in the last century. And so these boxes, you can see a lot of this work I started when I was with the Vincent Wildlife Trust. So bottom left is one of the VWT den box designs. This is the Rolls Royce of den boxes. They're big, they're heavy, they're expensive, but the pine martens love them and they breed in them every year. And we've refined our approach to getting them up the trees and checking them so as to minimize disturbance. It's all done under licenses from what used to be SNH, now Nature Scot. And a lot of what we do now is actually training other people who are interested in helping pine martens in various ways. We, the one at the bottom with me in the red helmet, we don't handle, that's a pine marten kit with its eyes shut. We don't handle them very often these days. We're much more hands-off than we used to be. But in parts of the study, we wanted to know things like what the litter size was, what the weight and age of the kits was when we were visiting. But now we're much more hands-off and we check the boxes using thermal imaging scopes. So you can tell if there's a heat signal from the mother and the kits in the box, and then you can stick up a camera trap to confirm the species that's coming and going, to confirm that it's pine marten. A magical time. We've worked with some wonderful people, had great collaborations with the foresters, and I can't stop it. I'm supposed to be retired, but I still do that sort of thing once or twice a year. We're actually handing on the Galloway Forest project to a voluntary group called the Dumfries and Galloway Pine Marten Group. And they're a bunch of people. And we'll be going up there again this May to help train up that group to take over the work.
But I suspect once that group gets established and going, it's not going to stop you going up anyway, is it?
No. We have other projects in other forests in southern Scotland and northern England, where pine martens are only recently getting re-established. One of the constraints for pine martens is, apart from being a bit fussy about their habitat, they are really slow breeders. The typical litter size in our den boxes is just two kits. The most we've ever had is three. So their capacity to recover is very limited when conditions improve. And that's why the recovery in Scotland has taken a good 100 years since their low point back in the 1910s. It's been a very slow, drawn out process.
So we talked a bit already about swift ecology, and I don't want to go over what we've already talked about, but having been through a similar journey myself with echoes, when I basically came out of echoes in 2017, I think was when I was no longer a director there. And I was actually in the middle of a woodland at midnight, I think it was the end of August, with a group of bat people that I was training, and they were aware of my involvement with echoes, obviously, and they were aware that as of the last day of August, I was no longer going to be managing director of echoes. And we're in this woodland, and I hadn't noticed the time, and one of the trainees came up to me and said, "How does it feel?" And I looked at them and I said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "It's 10 past midnight. You're no longer managing director of Echoes Ecology." Right? And that moment had kind of passed me by. But I did actually have to explain to the person how I felt. And how did you feel? You know, how did you feel? You've created this thing, Swift Ecology. You've put so much time, effort, blood, sweat, tears, goodness knows what, into this. You're emotionally attached to it. You must be emotionally attached to it. Yeah. To then kind of remove yourself from it. What was that like for you? Was that a difficult decision?
Not a difficult decision, because I knew this was when would it have been? I was in my early 60s, I suppose. I already detected that keeping on top of some aspects of the business, I could still do it, but it was more of a strain, balancing all the jobs, all the clients, keeping all the details in my head. The sorts of things that when your brain is in its prime, you can do without much strain at all. As you get beyond your late 50s into your 60s, I just found it became more of a strain, and I didn't need that strain at that stage in life. So it was a relief in one sense to be able to say, right, I'm going. On the other hand, as you will know, Neil, it's like handing over your precious baby or your precious teenage child to another bunch of people. They weren't strangers, obviously. I I'm very fond of them, and I knew it would be okay. So it was a real mixture of emotions, really. Some relief that I could actually switch my brain off from having to juggle so many different cases and keep stuff in my head that was just clutter, but important clutter. Balancing that relief with the anxiety of passing on something that we had created, that we valued and were proud of, and crossing fingers and just hoping that it would be okay. Unfortunately, I live close to some of the other staff, including one of the directors, and we meet up quite often. I do training courses for them. In fact, the webinar on Pine Martin survey methods that I did for you, a bit later, a few weeks later, I delivered it for the Swift Ecology team on their Christmas gathering. And some of them even stayed awake. So I'm still there, kind of on the horizon or up in a cloud, looking down on how it's going. And it's nice to have that connection still. And I'm proud to say that Swift is still doing fine. And it's still a really ethical consultancy with great integrity and honesty. And so I'm pleased.
Good. No, well, it's just interesting to hear your thoughts on that. Having gone through something very similar myself, I always find it fascinating to hear other people, what their thinking has been as part of that process. And like you, I'm on very good terms with the team that's at Echoes. And what the team at Echoes have actually demonstrated, I don't know if this has happened at Swift as well, but what the team at Echoes have demonstrated is they're actually a lot better without me. So, which is kind of nice, you know, it's kind of nice. It's lovely, it's lovely. Okay, let's talk about books and papers and your contributions in this respect. Wow, you've done quite a lot here, and what I'm showing here, there's a whole lot of stuff that's not on here that I'm not showing. There's at least one other book. There's a whole lot of academic papers that you've been involved with as a co-author. There's a reports that I know you've done for the likes of Scottish Natural Heritage, as it used to be, as you said earlier. And there's a lot of stuff out there, but I'm imagining the book Mink. Was this your first formal sort of publication?
That I was asked to write that by the Mammal Society. It was part of a series that they produced that was really nice, glossy, quite short. The one on the pine martin immediately to the right of it, that was the one I did a bit later. I count myself as a bit of a wordsmith. I like words. I like constructing attractive text to engage people. I struggle sometimes because so much of my training has been for scientific writing that it can become a straitjacket, because in scientific writing you've got to leave all the emotion out of it, and that's once you've been trained down that route, it can be really hard, I found, to let the emotion and the passion and the love show in more popular styles of writing. And I really admire some authors who can do both with great ease, because I don't find it easy. So yes, I've written a lot of scientific papers on mustelids mainly. But the things I think that give me the greatest pleasure is where I'm allowed to write in a more popular style. And yes, the two Mammal Society ones, the mink and the pie martin, top left, they were great. And I just felt immensely proud with that mink one when you first get a batch through the post and you touch it and you think, crikey, this is something I've created. And it could last for years. You know, somebody in 100 years' time may find that in a bookshop in Hay on Wye, or I don't know, what's the place in Galloway?
Castle Douglas or Dumfries or
It's south of Newton Stewart. It's the Scottish book town, and it's
goodness,
gone out of my head.
I was going to shout across the room. What's the town in Dumfries, Galloway, just south? It's the book town, Wickton. Is it? Hmm. Say again. Wickton. Is it Wickton?
Yes, it is. It's Wickton.
Wickton. Anyway. Sorry, folks. I was just shouting across the room to Aileen there to see if she had the answer, and she confirmed the answer. Yeah, Wickton. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, those two, they're little booklets, really. Then I was so proud when I'd done a lot of work on polecats with the Vincent Wildlife Trust, and it was a golden period. And one of the things that I was acutely aware of with polecats is that there was this, you know, this native British mammal that our ancestors so nearly drove to extinction. It was saved by the First World War, basically, when a lot of gamekeepers and farmers went across the channel to fight in the trenches. And never since then has the persecution of predators achieved the same level. So things could start to recover, as polecats did. And I was acutely aware that this mammal was becoming more widespread and yet totally unfamiliar to most people, because it doesn't feature on tea towels and placemats and stuff like that. So when I was approached by Whitet Books Limited about writing a book about polecats, and I was over the moon. It was a real, and this was also while I was still with Swift Ecology. So I had to fit that in as well as being chair of the Mammal Society and being a father and doing stuff. But what I love about that series with Whitet is that they do allow you, in fact, they encourage you to bring humour in to your writing. So long as you're delivering good information in whatever way. And that I found that really exciting. And I was, I'd known of the series of books. The first one I bought was Book Bats by Phil Richardson.
Yeah, I've read that book, and a very interesting, but yes, with humour style of writing. Yeah.
Yeah, some of his jokes were horribly corny, actually. But anyway, so some of mine, I mean, some of mine are awful. They shouldn't be allowed. But what I loved about Whitet was that they were happy to include a lot of quite wacky humour in order to sell the message. And so in both Polecats and then later I wrote the Pine Martins book, and it was an opportunity for me to play around with a new style of writing, popular science, and I loved it. It was a really rich period for me, a creatively rich period. I had to do an awful lot of researching of other people's work as well, so it's not just describing what I did. It's describing all the research that's been done recently on both those species across their European range. And I'm really proud of those two books. Interestingly, Pine Martins is still selling quite well. Polecats is always a bit more of a niche book because there aren't so many people interested in them. So Pine Martins is the bigger seller. And yeah, I take my hat off. I say a big thank you to Whitet Books for letting me use their facilities to get these books out there. My awful sense of humour.
Yeah. So how did you find the actual writing process? Did you have to steal yourself away for days or weeks on the end, or did you just kind of dip in and out of it, and eventually it kind of came together? I mean, how was that for you?
Yeah, very good question that. I was lucky that I was not pressed hard by the editor for deadlines. They were quite relaxed about that, which was a great comfort. It meant that many times I was able to choose when I wanted to write to fit with the mood I found myself in. And I knew, because of other stuff going on in my life, I knew there were days when there was just no point trying to sit down and write something because it wouldn't come out well. So I was able to wait until my brain was in the right state. And I would then sit down and shut myself away, often for part of a day or even a whole day. The other thing that really helped was I live on the side of the Malvern Hills on the border between Worcestershire and Herefordshire. And the hills are like a spiritual lung for so many people around here. During COVID, they were almost loved to death by people going out for their regular, you know, their permitted spell of exercise. But I use them. You get up high on a hill and look down on the landscape, and ideas come to you, and good phrases and sentences for books come to you, where otherwise, when you're down in the house or in the garden, in the clutter of life, they don't come to you in quite the same clear way. Yeah. So that was really useful, to have the hills to walk up with a dog or two. And yeah, that's where an awful lot of my ideas came to me up there.
Did you have a notebook or a dictaphone with you when you did that?
Because I was terrified of forgetting something on the way back down the hill into the village. And then, oops, what did I think of? Where's it gone? So, you're right. I felt naked if I went up there without a pen and paper.
Yeah, that's happened to me a few times, usually in the middle of the night. I would maybe wake up and and something would just come to me. It would be a sentence or something like that. And I would say, right, I'm going to remember that in the morning. Mm-hmm. And then you wake up in the morning and you haven't got a clue. You just don't, it's just totally gone. And that's happened to me maybe a handful of times. And I still don't have a clue what any of those things were. it's gone forever. Yeah. How did you find... Okay, so you've written it all, you've submitted the manuscript, how did you find the copy editing process, the proofreading process, that bit of it? Was it quite kind to you, or did you find that quite a challenge? Yeah.
No, because they were really kind to me. I have to admit, I am quite a perfectionist about use of language.
Okay.
I wouldn't send text to the editor if I didn't myself believe it was perfect and free of errors.
Okay.
And I was terribly fortunate that my editor, Shirley, was very like-minded with me. There were very few occasions when she would request a change.
Okay.
And so the relationship was a very easy one for me. I mean, I don't know what it's like for other authors in the series, but I got the impression that she was pleased that my text was pretty close to what she wanted most of the time. So there was very little in the way of stress and strain and conflict, which made it all the more pleasing and pleasant for me as a process.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. That's a bit of the process where we did the first book here, the Social Calls book, and we thought we'd finished it, you know. We submitted it, and as far as I was concerned, that was it, you know, it was finished. It had only just started. I would get the copy editor sending the stuff back to me, and... Every single page, making suggestions, changes, not necessarily, it was things like consistency and stuff like this, you know, and certain things that I would do when I write, that I would always do, which weren't necessarily correct, that had to be changed. And I very, very quickly learned, you know, I can't fight against this. You know, I've just got to go with what they want, because any other way, it's just going to be too painful. You know, so, but it's just interesting. I'm pleased that you haven't had that experience to some extent. Yeah, no, brilliant stuff, brilliant stuff. So, yeah, as a thank you for your time, we often give donations to charities, organizations, or whatever, and you've chosen Extinction Rebellion. Do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are now, post-retirement, I suppose, because you do describe yourself as a conservationist activist, you know, in the early description. Tell us a little bit about that and, you know, your feelings towards Extinction Rebellion and the work that they do. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Neil. And you may have to cut me off at some point in case I go on for too long. But if I go back to my career in nature conservation, towards the end, I realized that although in Britain we are really good at doing nature conservation, through my career, with the exception of a couple of the species that I've studied, well, three maybe, otters, polecats, and pine martens, they've recovered. But pretty well everything else has gone down. I used to do bird surveys for the BTO, British Trust for Ornithology, breeding bird surveys near where I live. And over the 25 years I did those annual surveys, we lost several species, even quite common ones. So although we're good at conservation, we've not stopped the decline of most British wildlife. And let's not forget, we are described as one of the most nature depleted countries in the world. And yet we're still losing stuff. So I realized that there are systemic causes to the problem that we're not addressing adequately. So no matter how good we are at conservation, we're winning a few battles, but we're losing the war because we're not tackling the big systemic issues like patterns of human consumption and waste disposal, and the fact that even if we have good wildlife legislation, if our economic and political systems aren't able to value nature properly, then nature will always lose out to the profit motive. So it was a realization of that and its impact on our wildlife and its disappearance, combined with the growing evidence of global heating impacting our climate and again our wildlife. And they're interlinked, really. Biodiversity loss and climate change, they're two sides of the same coin. They both have systemic origins to do with how we use stuff and dispose of stuff. So I came late on in my career to realize that, yeah, we've got to keep doing conservation. But if we're not also tackling the causes of the big, big problems, then we're failing. So through my career, I've done a lot of writing to my MP. I've joined campaigns by Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace. I've done lots of lobbying and gone on peaceful marches and things. And they've not really made the difference. We have to try something different. And in spring 2019, this new, noisy, outrageous organization called Extinction Rebellion came on the scene with a different approach. They were trying a different way of putting pressure where it needed to be put, not on individuals, But on those in positions of power and influence who could really make the difference, like government and the big corporations and finance and the fossil fuel industry, those are the organizations that can save us from catastrophe, basically. And that's what we're on. We're on this is all good science. The science is clear. We're on a trajectory of global heating that will take us to serious environmental breakdown and societal collapse if we don't do something very fast and very soon. And Extinction Rebellion were the organization that I struck a chord with for me. They were nonviolent. They were rooted in scientific evidence in their demands, and they were putting pressure where pressure needs to be put. So I never thought I would say it, but I became an activist. I've not been arrested, although brave friends of mine have been. But I want to look my grandchildren in the eye when I'm very, very old and say, I didn't sit there and do nothing for your future. I wanted to make a difference in the best way I could. Go on the Extinction Rebellion website. You'll find out all about it. Thank you for letting me rant on a bit, Neil.
Absolutely. And I think it's always fascinating to hear people's thoughts on the kind of stuff you've just been talking about there, and fascinating to hear your thought process, state of mind currently when it comes to this kind of stuff. And I'm pleased. I'm pleased that I gave you the opportunity to put that across. Yeah. So, got a question for you now, just as we're getting to the close. I want you to cast your mind back now. Maybe late teenager years or early 20s. Could you have ever envisaged, the life that you were going to have over the coming decades would take you into areas of important research, ownership of an ecological consultancy, an author of numerous books, etc., etc.? If someone had said to you in your early 20s, this is where all this is going, Johnny, what would have your reaction to that been?
I think I would have been pleasantly surprised and possibly unbelieving. I'm not the sort of person, never have been the sort of person that really plans ahead in any sort of detail. I knew I always wanted to be involved in wildlife conservation in some way, but the detail didn't really matter to me. So a lot of things possibly happened by chance or by luck. Some stuff I grafted for, obviously. I think I would have smirked and said, "God, get away, never."
Yeah.
And I've been really lucky. And I droned on about how miserable things are, but I have been so fortunate to spend a lot of my time studying species that are recovering. And, I know so many people whose mental health is not great because they care about the state of our wildlife and the planet. And I've been lucky, really lucky, to be involved in species like polecats and pine martens that are actually bucking the trend. Maybe I was really good in a former life and deserved a bit of a let off on this one.
Yeah. Well, it's been amazing. It's been amazing talking to you, and it's been amazing finding out so much more about you. And I've really enjoyed the last hour or so that we've been doing this. So what we normally do at this stage, Johnny, is I'm going to close things off from my perspective, and then I'll ask you to say a final few words, just in conclusion, whatever you feel is appropriate. And at that point, we'll stop the recording. But before Johnny does that, I just want to say, wow, that was amazing. Now and again on Battability for these interviews, we do have people come on who aren't in the bat world. So Johnny is not the first person to do a non-talking bat, talking bat. I hope, however, you have heard and seen the passion, the knowledge, the challenges and everything else that Dr. Johnny Burks has had throughout his career and still goes on. He's still very heavily involved, as he's discussed earlier, with doing certain aspects of conservationist type work, activist type work, research, etc. So it's pleasing to hear that there is more to come, I know for sure. But I just want to close things off from my perspective and just say, wow, that was amazing. I am so pleased to have been talking Ustalid with Johnny today. And Johnny, over to yourself to say goodbye, whatever. Yeah.
Well, I could say wow too, Neil, because your skill and your perception and your carefully considered questions have made this a really lovely experience for me. Your preparation in advance is very impressive. You've dug out bits of stuff about me that I'd forgotten. So I want to say a really big thank you to you for making this such a positive and warm, cuddly experience. I've really enjoyed it, and power to you. And I will end by just saying, in terms of the climate and ecological emergency that we face, bad things happen when good people do nothing. We need more people to consider themselves as activists. Don't be shy. Just be a little bit brave and join a huge gathering of like-minded organizations and individuals to persuade our government that they should be doing more. They know exactly what they should be doing. They're choosing not to because there are powerful vested interests on the other side. And we can make a difference if we all stand together. So, yeah, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed this Talking Bat interview, which is an edited audio-only version of the original videoed session. The full version, including video, is available via Battability Club, our online training platform. To find out more about Club, go to battability.co.uk. Till next time, thank you.